You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also chat with us on Twitter by going to twitter.com/thetakeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Lost and found.
I would like to inform the House that new and credible information has come to light in relation to the search for Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 in the Southern Indian Ocean.
Southern Indian Ocean. Some news out of Australia in the Malaysian jetliner mystery. We'll talk about that this hour. And we'll also take you into a dramatic terror trial courtroom in New York City. We'll visit an adorable and inspiring hardworking classroom of first graders in Portland, Oregon. And we launch our own version of the NCAA bracket madness all on this first day of spring. But we'll start off trying to resolve some fuzzy images that may be the first credible evidence of the fate of MH Flight 370 in a place nobody expected the plane to be.
We're past a search an area that's headed toward the South Pole from almost due south of Kuala Lumpur. And what we're being told by the flight crew here is that they have some intelligence now that there is some sort of debris in the water. They're not clear what. We will be the first plane on site. And we are just descending through the clouds right now. This plane has some of the highest tech gear available, much of it classified. If anybody is likely to find something down there, this plane has a very good opportunity to do so.
That's reporter David Wright, courtesy of ABC News, speaking from a high-tech aircraft heading to the location of possible debris picked up in satellite photos by Australia. Joining us now, Chris Yates, aviation security analyst. Welcome back, Chris.
Good to be with you, John.
And a mystery every day in this mystery that keeps on giving. What do you make of what's going on?
A mystery every day, of course. These satellite images that have been seen by the Australians, of course, all attention focused on this area of the Southern Indian Ocean. A couple of the aircraft have returned since seeing nothing. That in and of itself doesn't mean a great deal in so much as debris, if it is from the aircraft, can have drifted considerably in the time that it's taken from these images being received 4 days ago up until presently.
So, Chris, I'm going to play something for you. Here's John Young, who's general manager of the Australian Maritime and Safety Authority, talking about what was sighted in the satellite photos.
The objects are relatively indistinct on the imagery. I don't profess to be an expert in assessing the imagery, but those who are expert indicate they are credible sightings. The largest image that I've seen is assessed as being 24 metres. There's another one that's smaller than that, and a number of other images in the general area of the biggest one.
Chris Yates, what from a jetliner would float, would be 24 meters long, depending on how it entered the water, if indeed any of this stuff has anything to do with the plane?
Well, I could think of several items that would float. Most notably, of course, the tail section of the aircraft would likely float in so much as it's partly made of composite material. So that would float. Certain sections of the wings would float as well. And then, of course, we get down to the smaller debris, the flotsam and jetsam from an aircraft that would, of necessity, float for some considerable time.
If a debris field is found, one would immediately be able to determine whether the plane broke up before hitting the water or if its disassembly had to do with it entering the water and suffering the sort of compression that takes place in deep ocean.
Well, I would imagine that the wreckage will have broken up on impact with the water. As soon as the aircraft came down, it started to break up immediately that it hit the water, with some of the sections floating like we've already talked about, others sinking to the bottom of the ocean, and it's those items that will likely be the focus of the investigation going forward.
Chris Yates, aviation security analyst, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And now a chilling, taunting voice out of a propaganda film from a war long past.
Hello, Yankee brothers. This is your Japanese sister, the voice of truth.
Get Tokyo Rose.
Reaches out to you from the peacefulness of Japan, laden as always with love. but today also with sorrow because of what your superiors are making you do. It is impossible for you to dislodge our forces on Iwo Jima.
Iwo Jima? She's got the straight dope.
I am filled with sadness for you because of the thousands of Japanese soldiers reluctantly waiting to slaughter you.
That voice of Tokyo Rose from a real World War II propaganda film. Tokyo Rose was the generic name given by American forces to a number of female radio voices who broadcast messages from Japan designed to lower morale among the Allies during the war in the Pacific. A woman responsible for one of the voices was eventually captured and served prison time for treason, but was pardoned when it became clear that her conviction had more to do with calls for revenge and the national outrage over the attack on Pearl Harbor than any real threat to U.S. troops. A case with similar ambiguities and similar emotional content is taking place in a federal civilian courtroom in New York City. Suleiman Abu Ghaith, captured one-time spokesman for Osama bin Laden, took the stand and supplied some dramatic moments under direct questioning yesterday. He unexpectedly told the story of how he and bin Laden planned to control the taunting messages to the West about al-Qaeda after the 9/11 attacks. Joining us now is Karen Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. Karen, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What was it like to hear Suleiman Abu Ghaith under direct questioning about the 9/11 attacks and the moments, really days right afterwards?
It was actually fascinating. In all of these terrorism trials, we very rarely get to hear from a defendant. It made everything seem much more immediate. And he answered questions quite directly. He didn't try to evade them. And so it was wonderfully interesting. It was also a little chilling because we'd been hearing his voice for a long time in videos that had been shown day after day in court, one of them having images of the World Trade Center bombing. So it's been a rather emotional trial in some ways.
And he's not charged with directly threatening American citizens. He's charged with prior knowledge. How does his role as a spokesperson, as a propagandist, condemn him here or in some way exonerate him as a threat to national security?
Well, he is charged with conspiracy to kill Americans. And that is a very good question you're raising about what is the line between making a video and inspiring others to violence, which is what the government would like to hold. And it's going to be there are other charges, material support and conspiracy to material support. So it's not the only charge against him, but it's the most serious of the charges against him. And so that's the territory the jury is going to have to navigate. Is what does it mean to have said this? Now, I just want to just give a little footnote to something you said, which is that the defense is challenging the notion that he is the spokesperson for bin Laden and asked it directly in testimony by the defense attorney, you know, were you the spokesperson for bin Laden? He denies it. So he sees himself as somebody who was given talking points by bin Laden after 9/11 on what to say about how the West had besieged Muslims around the world, and that is what that's what's going on. And so even when we talk about it, it's so hard to talk about it without getting into the details of the charges themselves.
Well, he denies that he ever directly threatened Americans, and he told the story of this amazing meeting in a cave with bin Laden right after 9/11, right, where they made these sort of plans, maybe not spokesperson plans, but plans to get a message out.
Definitely. I mean, what he says is that bin Laden basically deputized him to make these videos. But what he also says is that bin Laden asked him to swear bayat. He didn't want to do that, which is an oath of allegiance to bin Laden. And so, yes, he definitely made these videos. We have both the audio and video of a number of things that he did. And, you know, in these videos, it's not just him, but also bin Laden and the other top al-Qaeda person, Zawahiri. So the images are terrifying in some ways.
How will the attorneys attempt to get the jury to respond here, to play on their emotions and say, if you're outraged, you should throw the book at this fellow? Or will the attorneys prompt the jury to say, this is a small fish. This person is insignificant. You don't need to convict this person.
Well, they're gonna try to say that. It's gonna be very difficult given the visual evidence that they've presented. But they will try. I don't know if it's such a small fish, but as somebody who was a cog in a machine and didn't know or have an idea of what the mind of the machine was about in terms of its operations. And they will cast him as somebody who believed in the message but wasn't out to either deliberately recruit for fighting or the rest. But I will say that the war metaphor and the war imagery has come up repeatedly during this trial. And I think the jury, that's where the jury is going to have trouble, is how are they deciding these issues and in what context? And I think the context they decide upon will determine their verdict.
Based on what you know about these kinds of trials, so who is Sulaiman Abu Ghaith most like in past convictions of people who aided and abetted enemies of the United States, do you think?
You know, actually, we don't have a real precedent for this. We have other cases where there has been recruiting online propagandists, like the American that was killed with a drone strike but was never brought to trial in the United States, Alaki, a couple of years ago. But in terms of in the courtroom, there's nobody that comes to mind. We rarely have somebody from Afghanistan who was with the leaders of al-Qaeda who's now in an American courtroom. We don't have those people. Many of them have gone to Guantanamo. Many of them that are accused of this kind of affiliation with bin Laden have gone to Guantanamo. So we haven't seen many of these trials over the past decade or since 9/11. This is also the first trial of its nature since bin Laden's death. So and it's also a trial for which the person accused, Sulaiman Abu Ghaith, is the thing he's accused of was crimes of in 2001. So it's historical. It's also historic. But I don't know that there's an easy precedent. And I think that's one of the reasons that the jury and the attorneys are sort of finding their way through this as it goes.
The one-of-a-kind trial of Sulaiman Abu Ghaith in a federal civilian courtroom in Manhattan. Reporting and commenting on that case, Karen Greenberg is director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. Thanks as always, Karen.
Thank you.
Later this hour, planting seeds on the first day of spring. The NCAA top seeds go to work in the tournament that begins tonight. We've got some brackets for you. Top TV characters going head-to-head in our parallel tournament at thetakeaway.org. Who's got the inside track to that Final Four?
Andrew from Orem, Utah. Archie Bunker, the perfect combination of classic Mark Twain comedy and modern critical comedic sarcasm. He paid homage to the old greats while giving birth to contemporary funny people.
What are you going to say when a woman is managing the Mets?
I'll say we have equality, right?
Equality is unfair. What's the point of a man working hard all his life trying to get someplace if all he's going to do is wind up equal?
It's all in the family. And from Gonzales of Florida, offering another family show, got to be Bryan Cranston as Walter White. So good.
I am the one who knocks.
So good. Breaking however you want to break it. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and vote in our bracket at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Hey guys, maybe today, first day of spring, is the day we can go outside on the playground. You can imagine first graders daydreaming about that while listening to their teacher. Here's Karen McDonald at Earl Boyles Elementary School in Portland, Oregon.
First, they will make a ball for the body. Then they will make the head. Last, they will decorate a snowman.
Snowman, oh well, so much for spring. Today we are going to take you right into a classroom setting that has become a model for teaching language skills. Oregon Public Broadcasting OPB reporter Rob Manning has today's glimpse inside the classroom of a school that serves low-income families predominantly and families where English is not the primary language. Manning says the focus on language and getting everyone on the same page at this school has delivered benefits to all students and shown that English as a second language techniques can bolster skills across the board.
The thinking is that in order for students to eventually become good readers and especially writers, they need to be able to express themselves in just speech. And one of the big strategies there is to get students talking as much as possible. So I've got one example. There's a first grade teacher, Karen McDonald, who has these exercises, sort of call and response kinds of exercises that just gets students speaking in English.
His name is Fred.
His name is Fred.
Her name is Stephanie.
Her name is Stephanie.
His name is Roger.
His name is Roger.
Some confident-sounding kids there, and from that confidence, you can begin to develop their own ideas in actual sentence structure.
That's right. She goes from that type of very basic structure of strict call and response to making it more of a frame where students are going to plug in their own names or their own words into a sentence that has a specific structure. So it gets them from just repeating into kind of adding their own insight or their own word choice. And so there's this exercise, sort of an extension of the one we just heard, where the students are describing these gingerbread characters that they've designed, and they're throwing in their own words. So here's some tape of that. It gets a little chaotic at the end.
I love that elbow partner. We all should have elbow partners, right?
Exactly. It gets pretty loud there, and then they partner off together and they do the exercise one-on-one, and that increases the amount of time that the individual students are spending talking, and they're able to further explore their own ideas in that kind of one-on-one setting.
I'm really interested in how English as a second language or language development for a diverse population who are coming from very different linguistical backgrounds really sets the focus on these verbal skills, and that can benefit lots of kids.
Exactly. And that's really where a lot of this came from, was it came from the English as a second language instructor at Earl Boyle's and others in the school district who were noticing that there were some difficulties with how English learners were acquiring English, but also that, you know, across the district, there are students who just weren't as fluent in academic level English as they should be. And what they have found is a lot of these techniques, things like the call and response, like the, you know, one-on-one speaking, has really done a lot to improve both students who come from non-English speaking households and those who come from households where there's just not a really high level of English being spoken, that these strategies work well for both of them. And it leads to, or at least they hope it's going to lead to better writing down the line.
So how do the teachers at Earl Boyle's take these kids from critical thinking to actually reading with fluency?
Well, for students who are not, you know, necessarily making that leap or making those connections as naturally, there are intervention strategies that they do, particularly for students who are in the bottom 20%. So they're just looking out a couple of years ahead saying, you know, if they're not going to be good readers by third grade, we know from the research that that creates problems down the road. So what they have are these intervention strategies. They call it reading club, and this is what that sounds like.
Top to bottom, bottom to top. Get ready.
In.
Get ready.
Walk.
Get ready.
It.
Ready?
It. Walk.
Get ready.
In.
Way to work it, Osvaldo.
Way to work it, Osvaldo.
What's going on there exactly?
Well, in that they are going item by item through specific words, and they're actually looking at them split up. So there'd be a word sound at the beginning, there'd be a word sound at the end, and they need to kind of eyeball how those go together and actually articulate them. So these are for kids who are really kind of struggling with some of those fundamental mechanics of reading. And so there are some who are actually very proficient language speakers who are good at talking, who can tell a good story, but who haven't made those connections in terms of written language yet. And the thinking is that between the two, between having, you know, a good sense of how to speak and how to string ideas together, and on the other hand, having the understanding of how words form together on a written page, that you've got really sort of two of the big fundamental building blocks of becoming a reader and eventually a writer.
Well, they certainly sound sharp in that drill, that's for sure. If a parent visited Boyle's, would they be enthusiastic about what's going on, or would they find it a little incomprehensible?
Well, I think there'd be probably a diversity of opinion, because I think depending on what you're seeing, sometimes it can seem a little, certainly very directed. And there are certainly going to be parents who think, shouldn't my kid be able to do something a little bit different than what everybody's doing in the class together? But I think when you look at how enthusiastic the children are about doing it, even those who are above the, you know, some of these, you know, the basic call and response level, those, you know, more advanced first graders, it's fun. You know, you're talking a lot. You're able to converse with a partner. You're moving around some of the time to talk to a different partner. And first graders enjoy that. It's just a more fun classroom experience, I think, than, you know, being a passive recipient or having things being, you know, that you're not as actively engaged in your learning.
Taking us on a tour of the Earl Boyle's Elementary School in Portland, Oregon, Rob Manning is a reporter for OPB. Thanks so much, Rob.
You're welcome.
And be sure to head over to thetakeaway.org. Just type /series/education for more coverage from our Classroom Views series.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
To the Middle East now. From stalling and challenges in the middle of a war zone, a milestone may be approaching in the Syrian conflict. 50% of Syria's declared stockpile of chemical weapons has now been removed, according to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. The fortified shipping port at Latakia, where the weapons are being offloaded, has received a number of shipments in the past week. From The Hague, Michael Lujan, spokesman from the OPCW, says this is the result of steadfast pressure and persuasion.
Just now, 30 minutes ago, we made another announcement. There was another consignment that was delivered to Latakia today and boarded on to the Danish cargo ship. And that brings the total up to just about 50% even. And in terms of overall movement, through to the end of February, only about 13% of the stockpile had been removed. Since that time, a further 37% has been moved in half the time in just under 2 months, in just under a month, rather.
What changed?
Well, the Syrian government was under quite a lot of pressure from the state's parties of the OPCW. We're a rather colloquial outfit, I'd say. Our success has rested on persuasion rather than pressure. But as we got into January into February and we weren't seeing much movement, there was quite a lot of disgruntlement that was being voiced rather loudly in our executive council. And I think, you know, other states' parties that have leverage on the Syrian government were using that leverage. And so also Syria had legitimate security concerns. And one of those was that they wanted to get these armor jackets manufactured that fit over the shipping containers that would add an extra layer of protection against small arm fire. And I think that was another contributing factor. Those jackets were delivered and ready to use at the end of February. And so they've been used in all the shipments we've seen thus far.
What categories of weapons and chemicals are now on their way out of the country?
Well, the priority one chemicals are those of most concern. That include the mustard gas and precursors, the main precursors for sarin nerve agent. All of the mustard gas was moved out of the country about 2 weeks ago. So that means that there are no unitary chemical warfare agents left in Syria. And as far as the other priority chemicals, overall, we've hit one-third have now been removed. And let's see, I've got the figure here in front of me. Almost 83% of the other chemicals have now been removed as well.
And the off-site, off-at-sea actual neutralizing of these chemicals now can proceed?
Not quite. There are two cargo ships, one from Denmark, one from Norway. And what they've been doing is they've simply been shuttling in and out of the port of Latakia to take on board the consignments as they've been delivered to the port from the storage sites. because of the security situation. So when, as today, when a new consignment is boarded on the ship then moves back out into international waters where it's protected by Danish and Norwegian warships.
Michael Lujan is spokesman from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
To the U.S. now, where the general can retire and pay a fine and move on with his life. Is that the real verdict in the Jeffrey Sinclair sexual misconduct case? Brigadier General Jeffrey Sinclair was ordered today by a military judge to forego pay and make restitution to the U.S. government amounting to a total of $20,000. No jail time. He was convicted of sexual assault after a plea was entered by his defense team earlier this week. With us is Roger Caniff, who's an attorney and prosecutor, former civilian consultant for the Army. Welcome back, Roger.
Thank you for having me.
Does this sentence speak louder than the case itself?
I don't think so. I mean, the sentence was definitely a victory for the defense. I think what it indicates is that the judge in this case, Judge Pohl, really wasn't considering, which I suppose he wasn't supposed to. He really wasn't considering any of the sexual abuse charges, which, again, he didn't plead guilty to any of those. But it doesn't seem to have come into his calculus. I think the judge's decision was more about what was in front of him, which was misconduct, adultery, misuse of a credit card, and other things. And he made his decision based on that. It's a very light sentence. I think it's unfortunate, but the court has spoken, and everybody will move on now.
Well, let me share with you some language from the defense team. Richard Sheff, who's the lead attorney on General Sinclair's defense team, had this statement. General Sinclair and his family are deeply grateful that the Army they served for 27 years ultimately did the right thing. This has been an extremely challenging 2 years, but Jeff and Rebecca look forward to turning the page and starting a new chapter in their lives. It's important to remember that General Sinclair took personal responsibility for his shortcomings because he's a man of tremendous personal integrity. We are grateful that the system worked, and here's the key, and he has been exonerated of crimes that he did not commit. Does this deal and this sentence and this verdict constitute an exoneration? Is that appropriate language?
I don't think exoneration is an appropriate language. First of all, in any criminal justice system, very, very rarely is anybody found innocent of something. I mean, what happened here was there was a very, very complex calculus involving the possibility of a conviction, expenditure of resources. You know, there were many, many things that went into the agreement between prosecutors and defense. I don't believe Sinclair was exonerated. I believe that the Army made the determination that the best thing to do for several reasons were to drop the most serious charges and to go forward with the lesser charges. So no, I don't believe exoneration is the correct term.
Now, looking at this in sort of a bigger message context here, does this kind of procedural narrowness give the impression that, okay, they certainly convicted General Sinclair, but ultimately maybe the Army isn't really terribly serious about addressing the concerns of the accuser here and the victim?
Well, the sad thing is it appears to me that the big issue was there the accuser, the complainant in this case, appears to have been inconsistent about when she found an item, when she found a phone, basically. So because of that, basically she stated at one point, I found the phone at X time. It appears that she found it at Y time. So this inconsistency was revealed. And in many cases, once it appears that a key witness has either been untruthful or been incorrect about an important fact, sometimes it is assumed that a military jury is not going to believe them about the key facts. So I think that's what happened here. I think they were faced with an inconsistency that was going to make it very difficult for them to prove the core allegations. And that's why the decision was reached.
So the takeaway here is that we shouldn't conclude much about the general orientation of the military regarding sexual assault cases because this case was so special.
That's correct. This case was unique, and I don't believe that it's an outlier case. I don't believe that it demonstrates anything systemic. It was a very, very difficult case to try because of the level at which General Sinclair was. It was a difficult case to try because of the relationship that had been in place. I don't believe it is emblematic of anything beyond its facts.
Roger Caniff, attorney and prosecutor, former civilian consultant for the U.S. Army. Thanks so much, Roger.
Thank you.
Here's what every corrections director in the United States will say, and I'm saying it too, is that the Department of Corrections is the largest mental health institution in the state. So we are a dumping ground. We have been for years.
That's Rick Ramish, executive director of Colorado's Corrections Department, reminding us earlier this month that the U.S. prison system has become a warehouse for the mentally ill. A facility where that warehousing may be reaching a critical breaking point is at the famous Rikers Island facility, possibly the most famous home for inmates after Alcatraz. And like Alcatraz, it's surrounded by water. In this case, the waters of Long Island Sound and the East River in New York City. Rikers houses more than 12,000 inmates, but it's not technically a prison because most of the inmates held at Rikers are awaiting trial. And 40% of all inmates at Rikers have a diagnosed mental illness, either when they went in or as a result of their confinement.
Like your eyes, you know, start to play tricks on you. Like you start seeing black dots. And you, like, focus on them. It's kind of crazy. It looks crazy. You're trying to escape seeing the black dots, but you can't. It's like, there's really no black dots there, you know? It's crazy.
Former Rikers inmate Ismail Nazario speaking there. He spent 300 days as a teenager in solitary, awaiting trial for assault and robbery. Nazario's account of his time at Rikers is part of an investigation into the treatment of young inmates at Rikers conducted by the Center for Investigative Reporting. David Alton is a video producer and reporter on this story. She joins us today from the land of Alcatraz, San Francisco. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what did you focus on here? There were incidents that really indicated a pattern of, if not abuse, then questionable policies regarding solitary.
So one of the early things we looked at was a report by Human Rights Watch where they interviewed hundreds of teenagers across the country who were being held in solitary confinement. And one of the numbers that came out of that report was the number of teens held in solitary confinement at Rikers Island. The number was 14% over the course of a year, and that in and of itself is considered quite high. When we started looking into Rikers and doing our reporting at various facilities across the country, over the course of various snapshots over last year, around a quarter of teens were being held on any given day in solitary confinement, which is considered actually, even by adult prison standards, an abnormally high number. And we wanted to understand why so many teens were being held in solitary confinement and for extended periods. We were hearing about 90 days, 100 days.
And insiders at the prison were quite candid with you about the consequences of this. Here's Dr. Robert Cohen, former medical director at Rikers, who's now part of the New York City Board of Corrections.
You can't lock them up all day long and then expect them to behave like anything approaching a model citizen or to be repentant. It's hard to imagine that response being facilitated and enhanced by being treated like a dog.
How does this solitary use at Rikers contribute to chaos and the difficulty of maintaining order there?
What research has shown, there hasn't been a lot of research done in terms of young people and teenagers, but when there's been research done on adults, the violence increases something about being isolated and being alone for extended periods of times really exacerbates. If you have any diagnosed mental illness, it makes it worse. And there's no transition out of solitary. You're essentially released suddenly into general population, and the incidences of violence have not gone down as a result of the use of solitary confinement. Temporarily, it's like a Band-Aid. It puts the detainee, the inmate, out of sight, out of mind. But then what's happening is a detainee is seven times more likely to hurt himself or herself when they are in solitary confinement than when they are in general population. So the violence, even self-inflicted violence, increases when someone is in solitary confinement.
Among the details in your investigation is some indication of the conditions inside some of these cells. Here's Daniel Drom, who's a member of the New York City Council.
And when we went into the cell, we saw a rusted bed. We saw a mattress, a foam rubber mattress about this thick, with mold on it. There was graffiti and writing all over the wall. It hadn't been painted. There was dirt around the edges of the floor of the cell. There was a small window to the outside, about this big. And there was a small window on the door as well. And that is the conditions that people who are in solitary, young people, adolescents, have to live in 23 hours a day. And that, to me, is torture.
Talking with Daffodil Alton, video producer and reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting on the condition at Rikers Island in New York City. So, Daffodil, do you believe it's torture that's going on at Rikers?
Whether I believe it or not, the United Nations has called it torture. I mean, they have already come out, and we spoke to the special rapporteur on torture, and he told us that it amounts to torture, and it's cruel and inhumane, and that they actually, as a matter of international law, have prohibited for the use on against juveniles. So, we wanted to understand some of the challenges that correction officials are facing when they're dealing with a complicated adolescent population, because in our reporting, we found out also that 3/4 of the teenagers who are in solitary confinement at Rikers have diagnosed mental illnesses. So we talked to them, we made many, many requests just to see, to understand, and they repeatedly refused to let us in to engage in a conversation. At one point, they told us that they were only an adult facility. So really, this begs the question, what is actually going on in there?
Well, you described the lack of cooperation, at least as far as your investigation is concerned, at the facility at Rikers. The closest you get to really hearing from the officers collectively is this individual, the president of the Union for New York City Correctional Officers, Norman Seabrook.
You go in to the belly of the beast and you handle whatever comes your way. But you have to be smart enough to be able to articulate to those young men that are in there, and they have so much testosterone that they are just, it's flying off the walls. And these guys are going at it, and they're going and going and going and going like the Energizer rabbit. They just don't stop. And sometimes you have to use force. And when you use force, I instruct my officers, use whatever force is necessary.
Daffodil Alton, it sounds like this is a situation that's close to out of control, even as he tries to rationalize some of the things you observed.
You know, in their rules and regulations, you can be sent to solitary confinement for having art supplies in your cell, for engaging in, quote, horseplay or noisy behavior. He's talking about teenagers, and this is how teenagers behave. But then you hear a transition to using whatever force is necessary. Now, it is there is a problem situation inside, and they don't have the training necessary to handle a population in need of therapy and counseling and services that are not being provided.
The problem of warehousing mentally ill teens at Rikers Island in New York City. Daffodil Alton is a video producer and reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Does the Earth, our planet, really care about spring? We humans, obsessed with the precision of the calendar, only get disappointed each year when the far less predictable forces of weather and climate don't seem to notice the equinox It's spring today, and maybe where you are, this difficult winter is giving up the ghost. Jules writes, the garden gates are open. That's great. Courtney is putting a positive spin on walking to work, 32 degrees and sunny, not wearing mittens. I think this calls for an iced coffee. I've got the next best thing, some spring musical suggestions, including this one here, to go with that iced coffee from musical legend Jeff Spurgeon, host for our sister station WQXR. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you, John. It's great to be here.
So we must find music to bring from the cold rocks and pavement of our freezing cold March days.
Yes.
Spring.
And there are lots of ways to do that. A couple of major themes happen in the sounds of classical music that evoke spring. One is the earth reawakening, and the other is birds. Composers like to put bird songs in because it gives the musicians something to show off with.
Well, yeah, flutes sound like birds. But on your sort of more elegiac notion, I mean, the low-hanging fruit here is Aaron Copland.
I think so, too, although it's interesting. You know, you hit Appalachian spring and you start the music and you just hear the earth reawakening. It's warm. It's the sun shining.
The birdies are getting up. Yes. The animals are coming out of their caves.
There's always irony in these things, though. Copland, when he was writing this ballet for Martha Graham, didn't have a title. She suggested Appalachian Spring, which is a line out of a Hart Crane poem. But it's actually a reference to a place where water comes out of the ground. So the idea of spring, we've laid that on as time's gone by.
Now, Vivaldi, though, he's much more explicit about the seasons.
The four seasons of Vivaldi are very handy for this kind of spring idea because there are sonnets that go with each of the seasons. The theory is that Vivaldi wrote these, but we're not exactly sure. But the start of the springtime sonnet is, springtime is upon us, the birds celebrate her return with festive song. Cue the violin.
Cue the birds. Now, would we call this program music? Musicologists like to, you know, categorize music. This is very directly imitative of natural things.
Absolutely. If you go through all four seasons, there are strong evocations. Summer has a beautiful storm in it. But yeah, this is absolutely springtime.
Next up, someone who loves to specifically evoke natural phenomenon in even the titles of his work.
Ottorino Respighi. In 1927, he made a three-part piece based on paintings by Sandro Botticelli. About 10 years before Columbus sailed the ocean blue, Botticelli painted what he called an allegory of spring, Primavera. And once again, you can hear the earth bursting into life in the very first measures of this music. Even the horns are calling for spring.
And the urgency for demanding that weather is really something we associate with the German composers, like Strauss, for instance, who, it seems, not only evokes spring, but says, get it over here now.
Very late in his life, Richard Strauss found some poetry. He was given a book of poetry by Hermann Hesse, the novelist and poet, who wrote a gorgeous, dreamy thing about spring. And nobody puts gorgeous and dreamy together better than Richard Strauss. And once again, there is birdsong evoked in the words. This time, the soprano gets to do that work. Vogelsong, birdsong, one long cry from, in this case, Renee Fleming.
And a sad note at the point of Richard Strauss's life and a moment, really, for European history when Hesse was writing.
And Strauss wrote this near the end of his life after World War II, so the whole world has changed. It's interesting in the four last songs that this spring poem is up-looking because the rest of the songs are pretty directly about end of life, evening, death.
We'll end on one of the most controversial classical music pieces ever composed, and it has spring, not water spring, but really spring in the title.
And a pagan kind of it, yeah. The Rite of Spring by Igor Stravinsky. The piece celebrated its 100th birthday last year. The bassoon comes in at a very high note, difficult stuff to play. And the world that's coming into being here is spring, but it's not an ordered kind of spring. This is cacophony. But the trick with this particular spring is it's the kind of spring where we want to ensure a good harvest, and for that, we need a sacrifice. And as is so often the case, it's a girl. So at the end of this piece, a girl dances to death or is otherwise sacrificed, but we will be able to eat this fall thanks to that rite.
Jeff Spurgeon, happy spring.
Thank you. Same to you.
Jeff Spurgeon is morning host for WQXR. So if basketball isn't your game, but head-to-head competition is, we've got a parallel tournament for the NCAA season.
Wheels aren't really seen as exciting technology, even though they are the original.
Give a think I might know what I'm doing!
Sir, I am not afraid to tell him what's on my mind.
Oh, in the game, yo.
Wow, is this one of your favorite things?
Oh, yes.
All men must die, but we are not men.
It turns out the NCAA's early history coincides with the early history of television. March Madness began in 1939 with the defeat of Ohio State University by the University of Oregon. Also in 1939, the television era began. Hey, look it up. So since the whole NCAA bracket business is really just a casino crapshoot parlor game if you aren't actually taking shots on the court, why not make a tournament to select the top TV character of all time? And we begin with a very March Madness sort of argument. Who even makes it into the tournament with all these possibilities? Go to thetakeaway.org and see who fills our brackets of TV greats. And you're going to say, hey, where's Roseanne or Homer from The Simpsons?
This machine is rigged!
Well, while you folks argue around your homes and offices, folks in the Takeaway offices will be defending our picks in head-to-head competitions on the air over the next several weeks. We are very Title IX here at The Takeaway. Men and women compete in the same tournament. Don't you have an opinion on who wins? Tony Soprano from The Sopranos versus Don Draper on Mad Men, or Liz Lemon from 30 Rock versus Mary Richards from The Mary Tyler Moore Show? Sure you do.
Television, say you love me.
Visit thetakeaway.org, join the argument over who are the top seeds and who are the Cinderellas, grab some bracket love, figure out who to root for, and follow all of the tournament action. The winners will be determined, of course, by your votes. Again, thetakeaway.org, and the games begin on Friday. I don't know, guys. This is totally addictive. Who wins? Captain Kirk one-on-one with Ben Cartwright of Bonanza. Samantha of Bewitched versus Jeannie on I Dream of Jeannie. Andy of Mayberry versus Sonny Crockett in Miami Vice. How long would Xena, Warrior Princess, last up against Team Lannister on Game of Thrones? All the big questions. Takeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy the tourney. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.